complained to the President of the United States, and that the President had taken the subject up with Mr. Gonzalez. But nobody on this committee pursued the matter to find out what exactly the President said to Mr. Gonzalez. There was a report this past weekend in the Albuquerque Journal that initially Mr. Gonzalez had refused to fire Mr. Iglesias until he was instructed to do so by the President. Nobody's asked directly whether he got any such instruction, either implicitly or explicitly, from the President of the United States, or what the President said to him about this matter. One might think that the conduct of the U.S. Attorney in New Mexico is an odd thing for the President to be talking to the Attorney General about, unless there's some sort of gross misconduct, but apparently he did. We don't know exactly what the President said, and nobody has asked that question. In addition, Mr. Gonzalez said over and over again that he had opposed a piece of legislation, which has now been repealed by near unanimous vote of the Congress, a piece of legislation that had been put into the renewal of the Patriot Act, which allowed the Attorney General to name a United States attorney without getting the confirmation of the United States Senate for a period longer than a temporary period. And it was put into the bill at the conference level. In other words, it didn't go through the normal committee process or through any direct votes on the floor until it was included in what's called the omnibus bill. That is the grand bill, and there, at that point you don't have, you can't vote for and against individual parts of it. And it became law, and it became the mechanism for trying an attempt to put in a top aide to Karl Rove in one of these U.S. attorney positions in Arkansas, where the U.S. attorney had been removed. And Mr. Gonzalez testified today that he had disapproved of that legislation, didn't like it, thought it was a bad idea, but he couldn't explain why the Justice Department had then urged its being put into the law. He didn't say whose idea it had been to put this particular provision into the law if he, the Attorney General, opposed it. And former counsel to the President opposed it. And nobody asked him, well, if you opposed it, whose idea was it? Who overruled you? Presumably somebody will ask that question at some point later today. These hearings are a particularly ticklish problem for the Bush administration at this point. We are probably less than 2 years out of the end of this administration, and in any administration, that is often not the happiest of times because the president is a lame duck president, and there's been a lot of water under the bridge, to use a cliche, and some of that water turns out to be foul. In this administration, these last 2 years are turning out to be particularly painful. In the last election, the president lost control of both houses of Congress, and in part because he had control of both houses of Congress until then, there has been relatively little aggressive oversight of federal agencies. And when there has been relatively little oversight of federal agencies, inevitably bad things happen. And the worms are coming out of the woodwork now, and the Democrats are in power, and they are gleefully exposing some of the worms in the woodwork, as many of the worms as they can find, in fact. And so now the president has an attorney general of the United States, and this is a key position in any administration, who is deeply wounded, who by account of the Republicans that we heard from this morning has a severe credibility problem on Capitol Hill. But he is an old and trusted advisor to a president who values loyalty, perhaps not above all else, but among the top values that the president holds dear is loyalty. And he has so far refused to fire the Attorney General or to ask for his resignation. And the Attorney General has refused to fire himself, to resign. He said again this morning that he still thinks, he admits he made mistakes in the handling of this episode, but denies that there was any improper motive behind the firing of any of these U.S. attorneys. And he said again this morning that he believes he can still be an effective attorney general. Clearly, the Republicans on this committee don't really think that, but they have not overtly, at least not yet, called for his resignation. Our own Ari Shapiro, who covers the Justice Department, has talked to Justice Department officials who have told him that the Attorney General believes that if Republicans do not call for his resignation, that he will have gotten through this process with, if not a vote of confidence, then at least a permit slip to continue as Attorney General. That's, of course, not really what Republican senators say in private. They don't want to be out in public overtly calling for the firing or resignation of their party's attorney general. Of course, they could make clear to the president that they'll do that if they have to. They would rather not, though. And when you talk to them privately, they sort of shrug their shoulders in disbelief and hope that the attorney general, having had his day in court, so to speak, and this is his day in court, will feel that he's preserved his side of the story and his reputation and be able to step down with some dignity. There was very little evidence today, though, that the attorney general has any intention of doing that. I'm told by sources that, among other things, the attorney general's wife doesn't want him to resign, that she feels that his name has been besmirched, and she doesn't want him to step down in that atmosphere. And so he sat there at the witness table today, taking what could, I think, fairly be called one hell of a pummeling from both sides of the aisle. There were a lot of things that he said he didn't remember. In fact, the critical meeting on the firing of these eight U.S. attorneys occurred in November of 2006 when the top brass at the Justice Department met with the Attorney General to present the final list of U.S. attorneys to be fired. And the Attorney General testified this morning that he doesn't dispute that he was at the meeting. This is a meeting not that long ago, less than 6 months, I guess. He doesn't dispute that he was at that meeting. And it is on his calendar, but he has no recollection of it. Therefore, of course, when senators ask him about details of the meeting, he can't reply because he has no recollection of the meeting. What he did say is that he is trying to do something at this hearing which is extremely difficult. It's to thread a very, very tiny needle, and that is to say, I made the decision for the firings. They're my responsibility. I misspoke when I said I had not had discussions about this. I misspoke when I said I had not seen documents. But I was not in any way intimately involved in the process. I left this to my underlings to give me a consensus view as to who should be fired. Yes, I was briefed regularly, but I didn't personally talk to any of these people. I didn't ask them for their stories, which I should have done, says the Attorney General, or somebody should have done. I didn't review documents to see what their peer reviews were. I didn't consult the usual Justice Department peer review process to see how they were rated. I didn't independently check what my underlings were telling me. I simply accepted what they told me, and then I okayed it. So it was my decision, to which the Democrats, particularly on this committee, say, well, if you didn't know the basis for firings that you okayed, your judgment is called into question. You perhaps shouldn't be attorney general because you just simply made decisions without knowing the basis for those decisions. And if you did know the basis for those decisions, how can you explain some of those decisions which you now say you can't? So there also is a dispute, a significant dispute, as to what the situation was vis-a-vis some of these individuals. Carol Lam, for example, in San Diego, the very highly respected U.S. attorney there, at one point named one of the top 10 federal prosecutors in the country. There were complaints about her from some members of Congress that she didn't have high enough numbers in immigration cases. And she met with those members of Congress, and she thought, apparently, that she had persuaded them that she was going after kingpins who are helping, you know, taking large numbers of immigrants across the border rather than individual small fry. And the Attorney General said she was acutely aware that there were Justice Department concerns about her. But under examination by members of this committee, he conceded that no individual from the Justice Department had directly talked to her about those concerns. And one of the senators said, "Are you telling us that when you have a concern, you send members of Congress to discuss this with a United States attorney?"
I believe that was Charles Schumer, Democrat from New York.
Thank you for making sure. I wasn't sure I remembered it right. So Neil is back, having done what he was supposed to, so I can stop talking to myself.
Well, in that case, what I'm going to do is ask you some questions, because that's what I'm supposed to do, and then you can talk to the audience as well as to me. There was just... is it fair to say there was incredulity on this question about the qualification? You know, who told what to Carol Lam? Who told what, if anything, to David Iglesias, the U.S. attorney in New Mexico? That there was just disbelief, I would say, fairly on both sides of the aisle here.
I think that's right, and you don't see the usual kind of defense of this attorney general that you do normally of an administration, top administration official. On occasion, you'll see a senator sort of going through the motions. Mm-hmm. Senator Hatch did that. Senator Hatch, who is widely believed to be one of those who might be considered and who would like to be considered as a replacement for Mr. Gonzalez. But for the most part, he doesn't have a defender here. He doesn't have a really aggressive defender here. They're letting him sit there and, as the Watergate saying went, twist slowly in the breeze.
And this is normally, if for nothing else, make a long peroration of 8 or 10 minutes in your 10-minute allotted question time, just to give a troubled witness a chance to catch his breath. And that's not been an opportunity here. And we've heard some tough questioning from Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, Jeff Sessions, the Republican of Alabama, even Sam Brownback. And I say even Sam Brownback, who's normally an administration supporter, John Cornyn, a staunch supporter of the administration. These are not people he would normally expect to be. And fair to say, I mean, this when another party's in power, this works on the other side of the mm-hmm. aisle too.
Well, and it's going to be interesting when the committee reconvenes. I think the next questioner up is supposed to be Senator Grassley, who is a very senior member of this committee. In fact, he's probably not the ranking Republican because he's the ranking Republican on the Senate Finance Committee. And he actually said to me in an interview, I think last week, on tape, he said, "This administration is trying to thwart congressional oversight." This was with regard to something entirely different. Mm-hmm. It was a Senate Finance Committee hearing where the administration, for the first time anybody ever remembers, had intervened in federal court to try to prevent a federal prisoner from testifying. And parenthetically, they lost rather quickly and dropped the case. But Grassley was outraged, and that was in Alberto Gonzalez's Justice Department did that. Mm. And it'll be very interesting to see whether Grassley, who's always been a pretty good soldier on this committee in terms of on the Judiciary Committee, whether he'll pull his punches or he'll join the beat-up session.
And this is the allegation of the administration trying to avoid congressional oversight. This is, of course, an issue that the Democrats have been beating for 6 years now. The Republicans are rather late to this, but in a way, there's a line of questioning in the Gonzalez testimony. This is about his use of a clause in the Patriot Act that was inserted sort of underneath the radar.
You were filing. I just went through this,
Neil. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to repeat something that had been gone over in great detail.
What I said was that we still don't know if he was so opposed to it, whose idea was this? Nobody's asked him that question and gotten an answer anyway. They've asked the question, not gotten an answer, and moved on. Nobody has sort of held his feet to the fire and said, "Okay, you're the Attorney General. This directly involves United States attorneys. If you didn't want this, Why didn't you stop it? And whose idea was it anyway? Who overruled you?
There has also been, but the whole idea is that they were trying to avoid having to come to this committee, and specifically, and then the rest of the United States Senate, to get people confirmed for these positions. And then the damaging email that was released 2 days after his conversation with Senator Pryor, which I'm sure you've described in considerable detail.
That actually I didn't describe. I'll let you describe it in considerable detail.
Take a breath, Nina. This is David Pryor, the Democrat of Arkansas, not one of the more firebrand members of the United States Senate, or those opposed to the administration, who in a conversation had a couple of conversations about the replacement of the U.S. attorney in Arkansas, and a man named Cummins, and the replacement was a man named Griffin, a previous associate of Karl Rove, and the attorney general assured Senator Pryor that they planned to go through the process of confirmation. In other words, his name would be nominated. He would be nominated formally, and he would be reviewed before the Senate Judiciary Committee, and then go to a vote on the Senate floor as to whether he's going to up or down would he serve. And 2 days after that, Kyle Sampson, then the Attorney General's chief of staff, issued a memo, an email, which described a process where they said they were going to delay to gum this issue to death, keep talking, to not put forward the name, in an effort to essentially avoid any effort at confirmation. And it was Senator Schumer who repeatedly went after this with the Attorney General, saying, look, either you were lying to Senator Pryor, and Senator Pryor went onto the Senate floor and said he'd been lied to by the Attorney General of the United States, or you didn't know what was going on. Your chief of staff was about to institute a policy, and you're an absentee landlord at the Justice Department.
Yes, and it's, you know, when you have somebody like Senator Pryor used that kind of language. Senator Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, said at one point to the Attorney General, he said, you know, I would suggest you call Senator Pryor and try to make amends here and try to parse through this so that he is reassured you weren't lying to him, or figure this out, because you don't want to have somebody who's as respected on both sides of the aisle as Pryor calling you a liar on the floor of the United States Senate.
And not come back and explain what happened, not make any effort to explain what had happened. In any case, we're about 5 or 6 minutes away from the scheduled resumption of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings, where the guest is he wishes he was a guest, where the witness is Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. Let me just, if you're joining us late, reset the scene for you. I'm Neil Conan, along with NPR legal affairs correspondent Nina Totenberg. We're in the Hart Senate Office Building. This is the grand hearing room where perhaps you've seen Supreme Court nominees being presenting their testimony before the Senate Judiciary Committee and various other big hearings. It's where a lot of television cameras and still cameras and broadcast media like ourselves can have access to the room with a fair amount of privacy. And we're in a sort of bank on the second floor of the very tall hearing room, and a glass booth that overlooks one side of the hearing room. Down on the floor beneath us, there's a long table that's covered in a tablecloth of...
This is the luxury box.
This is the luxury box. Is that maroon beige, would you say?
Red.
Red.
I think I'd call it dark red.
Dark
blood red in this case.
In this case, blood red. There's just a single chair behind this table with a single microphone, a glass of water, a pad, and a few pens, and the name of Alberto Gonzalez, the Attorney General of the United States. There is a well in front of that table where this morning there were probably 30 reporters. Now we're down to maybe a dozen or so in the room.
Photographers, you mean?
Yes, photographers, excuse me. And they're getting ready to take more pictures of the Attorney General when he resumes his testimony. Then there's a sort of horseshoe-shaped table on a raised platform above that where the senators sit. We just see Senator Charles Grassley, the Republican of Iowa, taking his seat, so we may be getting ready to resume the questioning in short order. But the Republicans sit basically beneath us where we are in this luxury box, if you will. The amenities are not quite the same as you might expect in a luxury box, but nevertheless.
One other thing we're looking at is, and it's sort of a new development, I have not seen this in recent years. There are a lot of people standing up with signs that say resign. Senator Leahy, the chairman, has made it very clear that they will be thrown out if they do that during a hearing, so that they're blocking anybody's view. They're allowed to hold their signs, but not in a manner that obstructs anybody's view. And there's been a fair amount of applause, sort of overt laughter,
snickering,
I guess we'd have to call it, snickering at answers that the Attorney General gives. And it always interests me, Neil, why anybody thinks that that helps their cause, but they seem to think it does.
I've only seen one of the these people ushered from the room that right at the end of the morning session when one man got up and started shouting and was quickly escorted out of the room. They're dressed, many of them rather colorfully, some of them in prison garb. I think that a reference to Attorney General Gonzalez's role in his previous job as White House counsel in what I guess has become known as the torture memo, and the policies of interrogation at Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere. Most of the anti-Gonzalez demonstrators are dressed in pink, women dressed in pink, representing the group Code Pink. And so that's what's been going on there. The room is jam-packed. It certainly was this morning. There's a row of press tables near the front of the room. And then there is...
You know, one of the interesting things about the Gonzalez situation is that, you know, if the truth were told, as one Republican senator said to me, conservative Republican senators have never been big fans of Gonzalez. They stood up for him at his confirmation hearings. You know, they took the blows for him. Mm-hmm. But they made sure he did not get a Supreme Court nomination. They and other, particularly social conservatives, have always been deeply suspicious of him. At the same time that liberals have detested the positions he took, like on the torture memo or saying that the writ of habeas corpus mm-hmm. doesn't apply and that Geneva Conventions don't apply to people seized in Afghanistan. And so he has no natural constituency up here even before this. There are not any real Gonzalez. The only Gonzalez close friend is the close friend in chief, the President of the United States. These folks are not. He stiffed them more often than not. He came up here rarely. He didn't answer their questions either in front of the committee or said he would get back to them, and then it would be months, if ever, before those questions were answered. He didn't come up and sort of schmooze with senators, have a little bourbon and branch water, mm-hmm. certainly not with the Democrats and rarely with the Republicans. I was talking to a new person in the administration, Bush administration, recently who told me he'd been up here schmoozing people. This is somebody from the White House who was astonished that there were no relationships that had been built. Well, you put this sort of ideological overlay, the fact that he has no ideological friends up here, along with the situation that existed in this administration for all the years in which they controlled the Senate and the House and thought they didn't have to build those kind of bridges. And he doesn't have anything to fall back on here. Yeah,
no independent political constituency
right.
of his own.
That's
he's
right.
never been elected anything. He's a friend of George, if you will. We're told the Senate is voting on the floor, which is why we're a little late getting underway. This afternoon session was scheduled to begin at 2 o'clock Eastern time and then bumped to 2:30. And we see a couple of senators. As we mentioned, Charles Grassley is in his seat. I see Dianne Feinstein coming to her seat. I think that's Ben Cardin of Maryland. And Attorney General Gonzalez has returned to the room, and he's now chatting with some staff members as he gets ready to resume his seat. But it's not quite certain that we're ready to get underway as of yet. A Democrat would have to be holding the gavel to begin, and normally they would take the chairman's chair even if Senator Leahy was not there. And don't see anybody assuming that role as of yet.
So knowing that somebody will probably write me a snotty email, I should say that Dianne Feinstein is dressed in a purple lavender suit and looks extremely elegant and very different from every other member of this committee who's in a dark business suit, really boring. Mm-hmm. For years I covered this committee, and there never were any women on it until the Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill hearings, at which point we got two members, and Senator Feinstein is now the only female member. But she stands out not just because she's female, but because she actually wears color.
Attorney General Gonzalez also adopting the dark power suit, in his case, a dark gray with a white shirt and a red tie, just to be even-handed on the sartorial scale. There are many photographers now snapping pictures of him as he stands in front of his seat at the witness table, and we're still awaiting the arrival of additional senators.
Sheldon Whitehouse from Rhode Island has just arrived. It's sort of an interesting name for a senator.
Indeed.
And
they all have that ambition, but not many have that name.
I suppose that's true. And Senator Cardin went out. He's just come back. We're waiting for Senator Leahy to come in because he would bang the gavel to start the session unless he delegates somebody to start. One of the other interesting things is that I don't know how long they're going to do this. In some ways, once they've gone through one round of beating him up, do they want to do more rounds?
Well, you'll remember just before the morning session ended, Senator Leahy said, "We're going to finish up," gave the schedule, and said, "And then there will be a second round. Okay with you, Senator Specter?" And Arlen Specter said, "Yes, go ahead."
Yes, and but the question is, how many people are going to want to do a second round? I guess the Democrats will want to, but it's hard to know how many of the Republicans, having put in one dose of their druthers, will want to come back for a second.
Ari Shapiro is with us. He's NPR's justice reporter. And Ari, have you been able to get any indication of what the Justice Department or the administration hopes to accomplish in today's session? We're having technical difficulties reaching Ari Shapiro.
But I quoted Ari earlier anyway.
Ah, so we've been through that.
We've been through that when you were gone again.
Wasn't there a movie since you went away? I feel like I'm reliving that.
And that's
shouting again from some of the demonstrators here in the audience in the heart.
The pink-dressed demonstrators. As I said earlier, I am very curious to see whether the Democrats, I'm sort of surprised they've taken so long to pursue the White House connection to this whole episode, to try to find out whether David Iglesias was in fact fired because the president wanted him fired or because there was a real consensus at the Justice Department, or so Mr. Gonzalez thought, because he wasn't on the list until November, I think. Very late in the process. And in fact, at one point had been thought about for a promotion into Washington. So the idea that, and Senator Domenici was complaining about him repeatedly, Senator Domenici, having initially recommended him for this position, we should remember that also that Mr. Iglesias was the model for A Few Good Men, the movie A Few Good Men, the prosecutor in A Few Good Men. Here's Senator Leahy. You take it from here, Neil.
Okay, Senator Leahy is back and just about to resume his place in the chair. Of course, not just Senator Domenici who raised questions, but Heather Wilson, a Republican congresswoman from New Mexico.
And she was in a very tight House race with the Attorney General of New Mexico, which is why, and they were criticizing Attorney General Madrid's handling of some of these corruption cases, which is why it was so critical. Their intervention, if it was that, was so critical.
Now we're expecting Senator Leahy gets up out of his chair and goes over to, I think, talk to Senator Grassley to say, ask him if he's ready to begin his testimony. Senator Grassley had been expected to be one of the first questioners on the Republican side this morning, but was delayed at a funeral. And we just saw Senator Leahy shake his hand, and now he gets back in the chair, and we're hoping that he'll grab the gavel so we can be quiet and he can start talking.
There's the gavel.
Well, welcome everybody back. As you understand, we had votes in the Senate, which delayed us going back, but it was the Court Security Act, which is a significant piece of legislation, which I know the Attorney General and everybody in this committee has supported. And we, a significant piece of legislation which we passed, and I thank all the senators who support it. As I mentioned this morning, Senator Grassley had to be at a funeral and would have been recognized much earlier this morning, but we'll begin, Senator Grassley, with you.
Thank you very much.
Charles Grassley, Republican of Iowa.
I've reserved judgment on what has happened with the firing of U.S. attorneys. I have to admit that it's been difficult. The inconsistent information has unfortunately made what may be perfectly explainable situation into something that many have already concluded was misconduct. Your testimony today, and I left about the time you were starting your opening statement, so I've missed everything since then, but your testimony today, it seems to me, is extremely important, at least for me, to sort through all the facts and draw my own conclusions. I hope your testimony sets the story straight and clears the waters. No one seriously takes issue with the statement that U.S. attorneys serve at the pleasure of the president. The president has the authority to hire or fire U.S. attorneys. If an individual wasn't pursuing his priorities aggressively enough, or if he wanted to, if the president wanted to give another candidate an opportunity, those things aren't against the law. However, it is improper for a president to fire a U.S. attorney for retaliatory reasons or to impede or obstruct a particular prosecution for unjust political or partisan gain. We don't want to see the independence, integrity of our attorneys compromised to a point where they aren't serving their district in the interest of justice. I don't know if the U.S. attorneys were fired because they were pursuing or not pursuing investigations or prosecutions based on political motivation, but once the administration started to make representations to Congress and the American people about how or why the firings came about, those representations had to be accurate and complete. Yet documents produced by your department are inconsistent with public statements and congressional testimony of other officials, and we just don't have a straight story on what transpired and where the motivations for what happened were pure. You're well aware that I'm very serious about conducting congressional oversight. Oversight is a core responsibility of my job as a member of the Senate. I'm an equal opportunity oversight person when it comes to that. Over the years, I've looked into both Republican and Democrats administrations with the same vigor. So to get complete and truthful information is important for me. But I feel that on many occasions, this administration's made a concerted effort to thwart my oversight efforts. Just last week, the Justice Department tried to block a convicted felon from testifying before the Finance Committee. I was glad to say that the federal courts disagreed with you, and in the end, we got our witness. I know that the Justice Department has produced documents to the Judiciary Committee in response to our request for information on U.S. attorney firing, but your representations to Congress need to be accurate and complete, or else our oversight activities won't be able to get to the bottom of anything. We shouldn't be getting conflicting statements from the Attorney General and or his staff. We shouldn't be getting conflicting statements at all. The story needs to be consistent, complete, and of course it must be the truth. We and the American people expect nothing less from our top law enforcement officials. So, General Gonzalez, I hope that you'll be able to be complete and forthcoming and candid with me as I ask questions. I'm looking for my first question to see what the environment was and the situation all this took place. I'd like to start by asking you for an explanation as to why there are so many inconsistencies. There's something about the environment you work in that would produce these inconsistencies. How does that happen?
So I think as an initial, well, first of all, you know, I regret the inconsistent statements. As I said in my opening statement, the misstatements are my mistakes, and I accept responsibility for it. I think as an initial matter, when I came out on March 13th and gave the press conference, and I made some statements that were, quite frankly, overbroad, I should have been more precise in my statements. It is one of the reasons is because, well, the primary reason is because I had not gone back and looked at the documents. I hadn't gone back and looked at my calendar, for example, about the November 27th meeting. And so, in hindsight, maybe I got out there too quickly, or certainly my statements were too broad. I felt a tremendous need to come out quickly and defend the department about accusations about improper conduct. And that's why I made the statements on March 13th. And in hindsight, that was a mistake because obviously we had not gathered up all the documents which we've now produced to the Congress. But I accept full responsibility for not being more careful.
So you aren't running a department where there isn't enough protocol so that everybody can be on the same page.
I wouldn't say that, Senator. Again, this was a situation where there was a lot of information. We're talking about a two-year process. Conversations and meetings that happened over a two-year process, and I did not do my job in making sure that I had all of the information before I made my first public statements. And those first public statements, I should have been more careful about those statements.
Okay. In prior statements, you indicated that you really hadn't been involved in any discussions or deliberations to remove the U.S. attorneys. But emails indicated that you had discussions with Mr. Sampson about this in late 2004, early 2005, and that you attended a November 2006 meeting just prior to the firings. Mr. Sampson testified before this committee that your statements weren't fully accurate, and your testimony today backtracks on what you said earlier. Why is your story changing? Can you tell us when you first got involved and the extent of your participation in the process to evaluate and replace U.S. attorneys, and additionally, who came up with a plan to evaluate U.S. attorneys?
Yes, sir. Well, the reason why my statements initially were incorrect is because I had not gone back and look at the record. Since then, I've tried to clarify it. I think Mr. Sampson even in his testimony said that I have clarified my statements. The meeting, the email that you're referring to, the discussion that happened in either January 05, as I recall, Senator, it would relate to a discussion that would have happened in Christmas week, between Christmas and New Year's, and just weeks before my confirmation. And so I don't have a recollection of that discussion, quite frankly. But what we have tried to do since this time, since early March, is gather up as much information as we can and provide to the Congress documents and make people available so that we can get to the bottom of what happened here. And I'm here to provide what I know, what I recall as to the truth in order to help the Congress, help to complete the record. But there are clearly some things that I don't know about what happened. And it's frustrating to me as head of the department to know that, to not know that still today. But I haven't done that. I haven't talked to witnesses because of the fact that I haven't wanted to interfere with this investigation and department investigations.
Who did you discuss the review with at the White House? Did you question any of the recommendations? Were you comfortable with the process and the methodology for the final recommendations? And what was your personal input in that process?
Senator, as to whether or not I had a specific conversation with individuals about the review process is not something that I can recall having, that kind of conversation. I had understood that there was a process in place where Mr. Sampson would consult with the senior leadership in the department, people that knew the most information about U.S. attorneys, and that he would bring back to me a consensus recommendation of the senior leadership of where there were districts in terms of issues and concerns about the performance of the United States attorney. Still today, I think that was an appropriate thing for a manager to do, is to try to identify where there were areas of improvement. Clearly, there were mistakes made in the implementation of this plan and in the review of this plan, and I accept responsibility for those mistakes.
The red light's on, but there was a question just prior that you didn't answer. Who came up with a plan to evaluate U.S. attorneys?
Senator, I think that was my plan. I believe it was appropriate to look to see whether or not the United States attorneys were doing a good job. Were they doing their job? I felt that was a good management decision to simply look to see whether or not the United States attorneys were doing their job. I think the American people want to know the public servants are serving them.
Did you get all you did?
Yeah.
Senator Cardin, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gonzalez.
Benjamin Cardin, a Democrat from Maryland.
Entire hearing here today, listen to your response to my colleague's question, answering my colleague's questions, and I find some things troubling. But I think what concerns me the most is after reviewing all the facts involved in the dismissal of the U.S. attorneys, having a chance now to really go into detail and understand all the problems that have developed, you stand by the decision to remove these U.S. attorneys. You've acknowledged, and rightly so, that dismissing U.S. attorneys would be wrong if it interferes with or influence a particular prosecution for partisan political gains. Your former chief of staff, Mr. Sampson, stated basically the same thing when he said it would be wrong if it was an effort to interfere with or influence a prosecution of a particular case for political or partisan advantage. Yet Mr. Sampson acknowledged that a factor that was used in the consideration would be losing the trust and confidence of important local constituencies in law enforcement or government. Mr. Sampson confirmed a question that I asked him, that local political concerns from partisans may have been influential in the firing. You've said a couple times that you had confidence in the process that had been set up. How did you know that wrong political considerations weren't being used in the advice that was being given to you on the firing of these U.S. attorneys?
Sir, I think that's a fair question. I certainly know the reasons on which I made my decision. And I, quite frankly, relied upon people that I trusted to make a recommendation to me. I think I'm justified in relying upon the chief of staff to bring forward to me a consensus recommendation of the senior leadership of the department. I'm not aware of anything in the documentation or anything with respect to testimony that would support the allegation that it was anything that was improper that happened here. But again, as I've said before, just to reassure myself, I did ask the Office of Professional Responsibility, and they are working with the Office of the Inspector General, to ensure that nothing improper happened here.
I asked Mr. Sampson at a hearing in this committee, what safeguards did you have in the process to make sure that that wasn't being done, that is, improper political considerations? Mr. Sampson replied, I don't feel like I had any safeguards in the process.
Senator, I would never ask someone to leave their position as United States Attorney for an improper reason. The truth of the matter is, of course, public corruption cases, for example, as a general matter, are not tried by the United States Attorney. They're tried by the Assistant United States Attorney and assisted by career people.
But the person who is giving you the advice, who puts it all together, says there's no safeguards in the process to filter out improper local political pressure that may have been exerted to influence who's on that list. And yet you've said in your testimony, I also have no basis that anyone involved in the process sought the removal of U.S. attorneys for improper reasons. How do you know that?
Senator, based on what I know, and again, and it wasn't just the chief of staff, I was relying upon what I understood to be the consensus recommendation of the department, in particular, the deputy attorney general. This was the U.S. attorney's report to the deputy attorney general. He is a former colleague. I don't believe that he would make a recommendation based upon improper reasons that a former colleague, a United States attorney, should be removed.
Now you know that of the seven U.S. attorneys who were removed on the same day, five had controversial political investigations in their jurisdiction, including in New Mexico, where there was a probe of state Democrats and Republicans were unhappy, that in Nevada there was a probe of a Republican governor, in Arizona there were probes of two Republican congressmen, in Arkansas there was a probe of a Republican governor of Missouri, South California, Representative Cunningham's investigation, which was being expanded in Washington, and declined to intervene in a disputed gubernatorial election that angered local Republicans. You now know all that. This was a unique process that was being used.
Senator,
hadn't been used before to remove this many attorneys for this type of a reason. Don't you see that this might have been interpreted as trying to send a message to U.S. attorneys around the country to stay away from sensitive political corruption cases?
And Senator, I think that's a fair question. And I spoke with the United States Attorney community, I think, the week of March 12th. And I told them what I expected, and that is that no one should speed up or slow down a prosecution or investigation in any way, is that we follow the evidence, we make decisions on cases based on the evidence and not based upon the target as a Republican or Democrat. And if you look at the record of the department, Senator,
but it's not really my question. My question is the public perception.
Yes, of course.
Mr. Sampson acknowledged a lack of foresight that people would perceive it as being done to influence a case for improper reasons. Your chief of staff, your former chief of staff, has already acknowledged that. Looking at all the information we now know, you still stand by the decision that this was the right thing to do, the dismissal of these attorneys?
I do, Senator. I do. One thing we have to understand, and I've gone back and thought about this a lot, believe me, and looking at the documents, and I had a conversation with the Deputy Attorney General about this, whether or not this was still the right decision. Did he stand behind his recommendation? And based on what I know today, I do stand behind the decision. Because I have no information to tell me that in fact, the decisions were based upon improper motives.
You disagree with Mr. Sampson on the way that he had analyzed what is out there? Or do you think perception is okay?
No, I don't. I think perception is very, very important.
You disagree with the perception that's out there?
I don't disagree with the perception. I think perception...
But you would still do the same thing again.
Senator, but I've also admitted mistakes in the way we did this, and that it should have been done a different way. The process should have been more rigorous and more structured.
Let me just challenge you on the process for one moment. I delegate to my senior staff for advice on a lot of issues, but they try to understand where I'm coming from on these issues. You had some very sensitive political discussions on at least three of these U.S. attorneys. Your senior staff knew about those discussions. Did it ever appear to you that maybe they understood that when they made the recommendation to you, that they were trying to go to adhere to what they thought you wanted?
Senator, I think I've been very, very clear about my commitment not to improperly interfere with cases.
And they understood the political contacts that had already been made with you, including the President of the United States.
Well, Senator, I can't speak to as to what people understood about what the President of the United States may have said to me. But listen, Senator, I have been very, very committed to ensuring that the Department makes its decision not based on politics but on the evidence. If you look at the record of the Department in prosecuting public corruption cases in particular, it's been extremely strong all across the board.
That's my concern. The message you sent out that it was too strong in some of the jurisdictions.
I would be
that's
concerned.
Why you dismissed the. That's the impression. That's why you dismissed the U.S. attorneys.
I would be concerned about that perception, and that's why I spoke to the U.S. attorney community the week of March 12th to reassure them that that's not what I expected of them.
I would tell you that public confidence is also part of supporting the U.S. attorney's office, and that has been undermined by your own acknowledgement and by Mr. Sampson's acknowledgement.
No question this has been an unfortunate episode.
But you would still do the same thing again.
Senator,
I don't understand that. I guess
Senator,
that's what
maybe I should rephrase it this way. I would use a different process. A different process.
Same conclusion.
Senator, it depended on what the recommendation would be coming to me. But hopefully, you know, I believe that we had a good process in place. I now know that that's not true, that it was flawed, and that we should have used a different kind of process. But I have no reason to believe that these were improper motives in terms of the basis of the recommendations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much, Senator Cardin and Senator Coburn.
Thank you, Mr.
Tom Coburn, a Republican from Oklahoma.
General Gonzalez, one of the statements earlier today you stated in terms of the insertion of the ability of the administration to replace U.S. attorneys, if this quote isn't right, please pardon me, I think I wrote it down, that you didn't think someone should decide who works for you at the U.S. attorney's office.
I said that I was troubled. Well, I can't recall exactly what I said, but The reason why I supported a change in the law, 28 U.S.C. 546, was because of the district judges making decisions about who should serve on my staff as United States attorneys. We had a recent incident in South Dakota.